Blog Talk Radio.
Life is a song worth singing.
Why don't you
sing it? Life is a song worth singing.
Why don't you
sing it? You hold a key in the palm of your hand.
Use it.
Don't blame your life on a master plan. Change it. Only you generate the power to decide what to do with your life. You're a fool if you think you're helpless. You control what you do with your life.
Welcome, 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 ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting edition of Solar Now in the Future with its economic impact on Black America. And you know, if you join us on a regular basis, I'm your host, Ronald Bethea, and today's date is March the 4th, 2021. And many of you know the slogan for this show, if you join us on a regular basis, if there's power in numbers, then the Positive Change Purchasing Cooperative captures that power for your financial benefit. The Positive Change Purchasing Cooperative, LLC, is a blueprint for economic self-reliance for solar and renewable energy companies, both large and small, along with increasing market share for African-American owned solar installation, design, and workforce development training companies to address the effects of high energy costs at our historically Black colleges and universities, to utilize Black-owned farmlands and HBCU campuses to develop capacity and initiatives for solar installation projects to bring down the under and unemployment of young Black men and women locally and nationally. Also to educate the Black community locally and nationally about the economic impacts of climate change and the need for environmental education in the Black community through more Black talk radio programs such as Solar Now and the Future with its economic impact on Black America. And you know, if you join us on a regular basis, that this show is also brought to you every week by the Black Sports Legends Foundation, BSLF HBCU Solar Radio Talk Show Initiative. And you can get more information about that initiative by logging on to our website at Positive Change, POSITIVECHANGE, P as in Paul, C as in cat.com. That's PositiveChangePC.com. Please stroll over to our FundMe link, click on that link, and you will get all the information that lays out this platform that you are, an initiative that you're listening to presently from the over the World Wide Web, over the being broadcast over the platform of Blog Talk Radio. We are streaming via Facebook, Twitter, and Link, and you can also find our shows on iTunes. So, yes, yes, ladies and gentlemen, we are still working on trying to get our YouTube station up, television station up, so we'll be able to bring this to you over YouTube, but we're going to keep working with what we're working with. As this little boy says, show me what you're working with, and this is what we're working with. So, welcome, welcome. We don't have any scheduled guests today for our show here on Solar Now in the Future with its economic impact on Black America, but you can be a guest, you know, by calling that call-in number of 646-668-4444. 646-668-2948. Once again, that call-in number is 646-668-2948. And please remember to press 1 on your phone pad after dialing the call-in number, because you will be in our green room and we want to bring you right on in to our living room so we can have a discussion about some of the subject matters that we're going to be talking about today. Now, many of you know who us who follow us on a regular basis know that we reach high and wide to gather information to bring to you, and we always give credit to those who we get this information from and that have put this information out. Now, our lead subject, our discussion today is, should big utilities pay for their bad choices? Now, this is an article that was written by Marcia McCoy, who works with the Energy Reliance Organization, which is called the Local Energy Reliance. They're a think tank that's based here in Washington, D.C., and they do an excellent job in providing information. And this particular article went on to say, advocacy group in Boulder, Colorado has made the case for why utilities, not consumers, should be responsible for the cost of retiring their fossil fuel assets. Oh, now the fossil fuel industry wants the ratepayers to pay for them having to retire these cancer agent causing facilities, which have also brought down the property values of African Americans, Asian Americans, Native Americans, Latino Americans, because I just don't believe in using this word communities of color, because that does not speak to any specific organization or group. And I think that Brother Warren Valentine this morning on his show over the airways of 1450 AM, playing the recordings of one person who I well respect, of Dr. Claude Anderson, who talked about how these terms, diversity, community of color, came in. And if you're not watching how these terms are used in public policy, you will think you're getting something that you're not getting. Okay? Now, for the episode for the Local Energy Rules podcast, which is hosted by John Farrell, speaks with Leslie Goldstorm, an advocate with the Clean Energy Action in Boulder. They discuss Clean Energy Action's white paper, a utility accountability, and how we can equitably transition clean energy future for a recent episode in the ILRS Building Local Power podcast. Now, we're going to go ahead and sort of jump right on in and let you listen to this gentleman and his guests here over this platform this morning.
Yes, I think as we look at the challenge before New Mexico, before Colorado, to some extent before Minnesota and many other states, there is an array of tools that can be used in a range of alternative approaches. But I think the citizens and the advocates will need to be empowered to ask those questions. That's why we wrote the report along with several other Institute for Local Self-Reliance and several other organizations that are supporting it, is to just begin the process.
Just because an electric utility has a government-granted monopoly, does that mean it shouldn't bear the consequences of its bad decisions? A new policy idea called securitization aims to allow utilities to refinance and cut the costs of aging fossil fuel power plants, helping them to retire early. But while the practice can save the utility and customers money, the key question is whether the utility gets all its money back, especially if its decision to build or keep the power plant wasn't in its customers' best interest. Leslie Booster, energy expert and longtime advocate with Clean Energy Action, joined me in December 2020 to discuss her new report, Privatizing the Risks and Not Just the Profits, How to Truly Retire Coal Plants and Fossil Fuel Assets Early and More Equitably. Quick note, this podcast is a rebroadcast from ILSR's Building Local Power podcast. I'm John Farrell, director of the Energy Democracy Initiative at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, and this is Local Energy Rules, a biweekly podcast sharing powerful stories about local renewable energy. Leslie, welcome to the program.
Thanks, John. Great to be here.
You have been working for years and years advancing the cause of clean energy in Boulder. I was hoping you could start by just explaining a little bit about how did you get into clean energy work, and why have you been so focused, as so many people have been in Boulder, on this idea of local energy as well as clean energy?
Thanks so much, John. Some people know my actual background is as a biochemist. I'm trained as a biochemist. I've always been interested in the interface of science and society. So I've worked on a wide array of issues in my now relatively long life. I'm in my 60s. So I've worked on everything from radioactive waste to livestock grazing on public lands to a lot of other things. But for the last almost 20 years, I've worked almost solely as a volunteer advocate on climate change and clean energy as a biochemist and someone who loves the natural world and a deep sense that we only know of one planet that supports life. There may be other ones out there, but they're a long ways away. That this planet is really priceless. And so about a little less than 20 years ago, as our children were in college, I said, I'm no kind of mother if I don't do everything I can to address what was clear to me was a looming crisis in the livability of this planet. So in 2004, with two kids in college, my husband, a teacher, I resigned from my job doing biochemistry research and devoted myself full-time to climate change. So if you care about climate change and you want to actually do something about it, not just study it, then obviously decarbonization, which is now a word that's widely used, but not wasn't one that was widely used when I began, you go there. Now a lot of the inventories have been done, but back then we just thought, well, electricity, burning coal, all of that is very likely the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions. So while there are literally millions of things we need to do to find a new way to live on this planet, we try to simplify this as, number one, decarbonize your electricity, number two, decarbonize your transportation, and number three, do everything else. And it's been confirmed over and over and over again that really focusing on decarbonizing electricity is the first, the most cost-effective, and the most generally effective approach. So I always say in all of our endless meetings here in Colorado, and I work with people around the country, I'm like, I'm a biochemist, ask me about protein structure. I actually know more about that than I know about a lot of these things. But you are forced, and I think that's one reason these podcasts are so helpful, because it can help people realize that we all end up kind of coming to these same realizations, even though we come from many different places. And just watching Jonathan Scott's Power Trip, I strongly recommend it, because you just see all these people from all these walks of life coming to these principles that Institute for Local Self-Reliance has done such a remarkable job of pulling together all these threads, cutting across many sectors of our economy and helping people think about a new vision. And so I just want to thank ILSR for that. So that's how I got started in clean energy and monopolies and securitization and coal and all of those things.
Let's talk a little bit about this specific issue of securitization. First of all, I just want to salute you in even becoming an advocate who can understand the issue, I think, is something to be proud of, because it's a complex financial instrument, unfortunately. I've heard it described by some folks as basically like refinancing a house. You know, you take the existing debt and you try to go out and get a cheaper interest rate. And then with the savings, you try to do something different. Can you explain a little bit about how does securitization align with this goal of decarbonizing the electricity system? Why are we talking about securitization? What can it do?
Well, I want to be really clear. I see securitization, which I'll describe a little bit more, as a tool. Like all tools, there's a time to use it and a time to not use it. I sometimes think of it as a sledgehammer. Sledgehammer is a tool, too. But you don't usually want to start with a sledgehammer when you have whatever you're trying to get done. And so it's, again, I am not a financial person in any way, shape, or form. I'm a mom who's trying to understand these issues. And here we go. So the concept behind securitization, as you described, is that when we retire, for example, coal plants, before the end of their useful life, you have money you still need to pay off, the undepreciated portion of the asset. And the concept behind securitization, the benefit of it, now I'm here to talk about why we need to be careful about using this tool, but just to begin with the benefit. The benefit of it is that when we pay off undepreciated assets in, a coal plant, at the utility's cost of money, ratepayers will typically be paying about 7%. So again, using the mortgage example, it's like having a mortgage at 7 or 8%, give or take, what's called the weighted average cost of capital for utilities, and of the cost of their debt and of the cost of their equity. And securitization allows the issuance of bonds that are likely to have a much lower cost of money, perhaps in the 3 or 4%. So the advocates talk about going from paying 7% on the money to pay off this undepreciated coal plant, the part that hasn't been paid off. Instead of paying 7%, you'll pay 3 or 4%. Just like if you refinance your mortgage, your monthly mortgage payment will go down. And that can be true. But I believe we need to begin with the question of who should pay off the undepreciated asset that the utility has. And that should be our first question. The assumption tends to be that if the utility has an undepreciated asset, then their customers need to pay it off. And respectfully, only a monopoly would think like that, because every other business that has a problem of whatever kind has to pay it off themselves. They have to write it off their books. They have to do all those things that businesses in the competitive world do. And respectfully, only in these monopoly-controlled utilities where they assume that somehow they can take, frankly, the mistakes that they have and make their customers pay for it. And I'll just, then we can continue on. But the bonds in the financial world are referred to as ratepayer obligation charge bonds or ROC bonds. But I think those words, ratepayer obligation charge, are important words because not many people like me, I'm a mom, right? I balance my checkbook, and after that I'm kind of not a financial person, let's just say. Securitization is very, you know, like it's scary, and that's one reason I wrote this report, is to try to begin the process of demystifying this. I think referring to these as ratepayer obligation charge bonds makes it very clear that the end game is to have ratepayers pay off the utility's problem. While that may be a tool that we want to use, we should ask many questions before we think that somehow securitization is the key. And then just go back, obviously, if you can pay off an undepreciated coal plant at 3 or 4% instead of 7%, it makes it more cost-effective to do it. If we're trying to accelerate the retirement of coal plants, that is one possible tool for doing it. There are many other possible tools, including having the utility own the mistakes. They're the ones who've made the profits for all these years. They can afford to bear some of the costs of this transition that we're going through. They can more than afford to bear it, as we'll talk about. But obviously, we want to decarbonize our carbon emissions. I'm fully on board with that. I'm just not fully on board with assuming that ratepayers should pay off utilities' mistakes.
So the report that you referenced that you're working on now, but should be released by the time this podcast is out, planned for release here in mid-December, it was tentatively called Privatizing the Risks and Not Just the Profits, How to Truly Retire Coal Plants and Fossil Fuel Assets Early and More Equitably. And it is really a response to this conversation that we're having about securitization, because
it's really been touted by a lot of folks as this is a great deal. You know, just like me refinancing my home can be a great deal for me, it seems like, hey, if we can pay less to retire these dirty power plants, that's a great deal. But as you highlight, the sort of missing piece of the conversation has been, well, who owns things and who pays for them? Because when I refinance my own home, I'm the only one that's paying for it. There's not some third party involved who initially bought the house and has been making investments in it or has been using my money to make investments in it. I don't know if the analogy is really going to hold up. The idea that a refinance is a good thing from that perspective sort of trivializes that very important distinction between who's owning things and making choices in the utility business under a monopoly system and when it's happening with a home. So let's dive into that a little bit. You've already kind of alluded to this, but we're talking about power plants that we want to retire because they pollute. And we're talking about power plants who somebody in an executive suite of a utility company decided that should be built at whatever time that they were built. So some of these power plants are older, some of them are newer. As you say, there are some costs that we still haven't paid in terms of paying off these power plants as customers, because we're usually on the hook for that. In over 30 states, utilities are monopolies, and so they get to charge to their captive customers whatever their regulators let them get away with. But why shouldn't we as customers pay to refinance utility power plants? Why shouldn't we be on the hook for that?
That's a good question. And, you know, obviously at this point, mostly utilities commissions will make this decision. And they could decide that customers will pay for some or all of the fossil fuel plants. I'm going to use coal plants because that's kind of what's right in front of us right now. Customers may be required to pay for some or all of that. And if you pay it at 4%, you're better off than at 7%. But my argument is that we should first ask, what's the equitable resolution here? And so the utilities did make the decision to build these plants. They did make the decision to, in our case in Colorado, customers may need to pay off some part of these undepreciated fossil fuel assets. But in most businesses, if you're caught carrying the fashions from 5 years ago and you can't sell them, that's your problem, right? And so the Utilities Commission are going to come up with some decision. I think it's unlikely that they will force the utilities to carry the full burden of having built fossil fuel plants that are no longer wanted, needed, or cost effective. But I don't think they should also just assume that ratepayers now are responsible for 100% of this problem that utilities have had. So in my mind, we should first ask this question. And in some cases, I'll be honest, there's a big coal plant in this state where, you know, the utility knew from the beginning they shouldn't build it. It's supposed to operate till 2070, completely off scale. And we ought to be asking that question.
Is this the Comanche 3 plant by any chance?
Yes, it's a big coal plant in Pueblo, Colorado. It's what's called Unit 3 in Pueblo. The utility refers to it as Comanche 3. And when we look at the analysis that just came out last week by Emily Gruber, it appeared in Science, you know, we're either the last or one of the very last coal plants planned for. I think it's important that we ask ourselves, given what the utilities knew or should have known, should they have invested in a $1 billion coal plant that they thought would operate till 2070? So that's kind of a Colorado-specific question. But when we think about the national audience, if you're in Georgia or Kentucky or South Carolina or, you know, Utah or wherever it is, you probably have a coal plant that has maybe 100 or 200 million left on it that hasn't been paid off. And all I'm trying to do is empower citizens and advocates to ask the question of what's the equitable way to deal with what are referred to as the stranded assets from our fossil fuel era. And I believe the answer will be unique to each state and to each power plant, to each utilities commission, to each utility. But I want to empower citizens and advocates to ask that question and not assume that because the utility has a problem, the utility's customers need to pay for that problem. No other business would ever make that assumption.
I think it's really important that you raise this particular question at this time, Leslie, because I look at the kinds of news stories and disclosures that we're hearing about the fossil fuel industry in general, that in the past few decades, they knew about the implications of burning fossil fuels, you know, since the 70s or the 60s. Like, they were even studying it themselves in the case of oil companies. And so it's funny to me to think, number one, we have this issue of what did they know and when did they know it in terms of the decision-making process. And we have, unfortunately, for a long time, let utility companies off the hook on environmental harm in terms of being able to produce electricity and not pay for the environmental impacts, obviously. And I think there's certainly an element of that to the kind of decision-making. But I feel like as well, and probably what has motivated you and has certainly motivated me in a lot of the work that we've done, is that there are a lot of cost-effective alternatives available in the last decade or two to building coal plants and gas plants. While we're at a point now where it is, in fact, generally cheaper to do those clean energy options, it was still at least competitive. And definitely when you take into account those pollution costs, even a decade or two ago. And to me, that seems like one of those important questions about how much customers should be on the hook is, to what degree could the utility have made a different choice at a similar price to deliver the same power to customers? And it seems that we're going to have several examples, I would think, across the country where it would be the case that they could have made a different choice and could have avoided this situation, and therefore the customer should not be liable for all of the remaining costs on these power plants.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. Thank you, John. I think you've said it very well. What did the utilities know, and when did they know it? So on a coal plant that was built in 1960 or 1970, I mean, they could have known. The science on climate change has been clear since the 1850s. Eunice Foote, look her up. She's great. She figured it out in 1856, if I remember. So if they'd been paying attention, even in the 1960s and 70s, they definitely could have known that carbon dioxide was going to warm the planet with very powerful consequences. But if you build a power plant in the 60s or 70s, it's pretty much fully depreciated now. Most of the profits have been taken. They were cheaper back then. So we're talking $50 to $100 million. It's not going to have a big impact either way. I still think it should at least be split. But not 100% one way or the other, probably. But when, as you get closer and closer to the 21st century, the role of a business person, man or woman, is to look ahead and to understand and to think about how markets are changing. And, of course, when you're a monopoly, you don't do that as much because you've got this captive audience. And so I think it's part of this discussion over securitization is also this discussion that Institute for Local Self-Reliance has done such a great job of helping us think about monopoly and near monopolies and how that goes. So, yeah, I think it's very important that citizens and advocates feel empowered to ask, what did the utilities know and when did they know it? And they could have known about climate change in 1856, and even a little earlier, actually. The closer it gets in time, I believe,
the more. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, you were listening to an interview that was conducted by Farrell with the local energy alliance here out of Washington, D.C. She was interviewing a young lady out of Boulder, Colorado, concerning who should be responsible for picking up the tab for shutting down coal-burning power plants that have cost the African-American community, the Native American community, the Latin American community, in terms of health, property values that are associated with these carcinogens which have been spewed out from these plants over the last 40, 50 years. And with decarbonization now being the hot topic to combat climate change, how that affects you on a bottom line, everyday consumer who gets a utility bill, and these costs are called pass-throughs. And as the young lady elegantly stated, the utilities are legal monopolies, and we're supposed to be protected by your public service commissions from around the country. And I'm not the one to say whether it's being done or not being done, but you can go and log on to our website at positivechangepc.com, click on our news and events tab, you'll be able to scroll down and you'll be able to listen to this interview in its entirety. I think that it's a great piece that's why I wanted to share this interview our listening audience this morning. And this information, once again, is being provided through the auspices of the ILSR and John Farrell, who is the managing director here at the RSL here in Washington, D.C. Now, we're going to switch gears very, very shortly because we have some other subject matters and things that we want to be able to get out to our listening audience who log in to our platform on a weekly basis here on Solar Now and the Future with its economic impact on Black America. And we're going to take a slight pause for the calls, and we'll be right back here on Solar Now and the Future with its economic impact.
Someone singing, I can just sing it. Life is a song worth singing. Why don't you sing it? You hold a key in the palm of your hand. Use it. Don't blame your life on a master plan. Change it. Only you generate the power to decide what to do with your life. You're a fool if you think you're helpless. You control what you do with your life.
Welcome, 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 ladies and gentlemen, back to the airways of Solar Now and the Future with its economic impact on Black America. And you know I'm your host, Ronald Bethay, and if you join us on a regular basis, you know that call-in number is 646-668-2948. Once again, that call-in number is 646-668-2948. Now, as I indicated, we're going to shift gears because we have another issue that we want to sort of bring into focus here and closer to home here in the state of Maryland. And most of you know that this broadcast comes to you from the state of Maryland. We are located out right outside of our nation's capital in lovely Tacoma Park, Maryland. And we want to talk about the issue of Maryland clean energy jobs. And if you log on to our news and events tab, you'll be able to scroll down and you'll be able to hear and participate a video which was produced by the Maryland, the Climate, Chesapeake Climate Action Network Group in conjunction with Power 52. So with that being said, we're going to jump right into this video, which is online.
We have business right now. We're busy. We can work overtime every week if we elect to, but if we get more work through the renewable energy credits being supported, we'll be able to employ more people and work more in the state of Maryland. We work the whole Eastern Seaboard right now. We'd rather keep all of our work at home.
The Maryland Clean Energy Jobs Act will invest millions of additional dollars into clean energy job training programs, bringing those jobs to Maryland residents. These are programs like Power 50. If we were able to get more funds, that means we could train more people and be able to create the access to hire Maryland residents.
So Power 52 is really designed to get your foot in the door. Solar in of itself is a phenomenal green industry, you know, to kind of jump into. But, you know, a lot of people just aren't sure on how to do it. Well, Power 52 eliminates that whole gap.
I didn't know nothing prior to coming into this program, construction-wise, solar, any of this, so I definitely learned that. My daughter wants to take advantage of it.
We've got many projects in the state of Maryland that are sitting right on the threshold of whether or not they can be built, many are shovel-ready. Without solar renewable energy credits, we're just waiting.
If this becomes law, it will make sure we have trained workers and that we have a continuously growing clean energy economy in our state.
This is the future, so don't buy it.
Yes, yes, ladies and gentlemen, that was a video that was produced by the Chesapeake Climate Action Group, and thanks to Jamie, who is their policy director, who sent that email to me, I was able to share that information with you today here over this platform, Solar Now in the Future with its Economic Impact on Black America. Now, as I've indicated time and time again, ladies and gentlemen, you can follow me this online by logging on to our website at positivechangepc.com. Click on our news and events tab. After you click on our news and events tab, you scroll down, you'll see the titles. It says, it's very, very simple. All you have to do then is click on the link, or it says read more. So you'll be able to get this information on our website at positivechangepc.com. That's positivechangepc.com. Go to our news and events tab, and you'll be able to find this information. And as we are able to continue with our show today, because we sort of packed this show with a lot of different subject matter that is concerning to not just the DMV market area, but a national format. Now, you're going to be able to find an article that talks about the state of Mississippi. Now, this particular article was brought to my attention by Mr. Bertrand Cowan, who is with the Mississippi Delta Business Alliance. And he sent in this article because there are a lot of things going on in Mississippi, and not just the utility issue with the water in Jackson, but there's a lot of ground opportunities that are there for our African-American solar installation and design companies. Now, if anyone has been following this show over the years, you know that yours truly, Ronald Bethea, I wear more than one hat. I am charged that as the sitting president of the National Association for Blacks in Solar, the vice president of the organization is Mr. Will Shirley Jr., who is the president of Sundial Solar, which is based in Jackson, Mississippi. It is the only African-American-owned solar installation company in the entire state of Mississippi. So with that being said, we are looking at who that just appeared recently in the newspaper. It was authored by Jeff Pendroff, who published this on February 24, 2021, in the newspaper Mississippi Today. This little article went on to say, lawmakers said Wednesday that $250 million wind farm is planned for Tunica County. Two major renewable energy projects are planned for Mississippi, including the state's first wind-powered farm. Lawmakers said Wednesday that $250 million wind farm is planned for Tunica County, and $140 million to $160 million solar farm for Chickasaw County. The state Senate approved allowing the local counties to provide tax breaks for these projects. Project Wind LLC would be the state's first wind farm. State Public Service Commission Brandon Presley said Chickasaw Solar Farm will be the area's third one, and several others are operating across the state. With recent wind power debate, widespread power outages in Texas, Presley pointed out that the projects would only sell power wholesale to the Tennessee Valley Authority nationally, not directly to any customers. Precisely said project has applied for approval with the Public Service Commission, but the Chickasaw Solar Project has not. The wind farm will have 100 wind turbines on 13,000 acres to be a 200-megawatt facility, able to power approximately 7,000 homes, Presley said. In light of what we have seen in Texas, we will be asking them about the winterization effort, Presley went on to state. Now, you'll be able to find this information. And the reason why I want to bring this information, because where is the economic deal for the black community? Our businesses, our HBCUs. In Bena, Mississippi, most of us know it because of Mississippi Valley State University, one of our historically HBCUs, is located in Bena, Mississippi. They have recently lost the utility company that has been giving them a rotten deal forever, has pulled out, but they own their own grid. There's opportunities that are present in our midst that many of our investors and people who are supposed to be quote-unquote brainchilds about business. But let me make one thing plain on this show. Everything starts with energy, and everything ends with energy. Make no mistake about that. Everything starts with energy, and everything ends with energy. And if we don't understand that, we will completely be left out of this new green economic deal that the Biden administration has put out here, and they're still talking 40% now. 40 acres and a mule? Does that ring a bell? Well, this is what's supposed to be the commitment. And the trick word is for communities of color and low and moderate income. They can't be both, because low and moderate income is not just people of African-American descent, Latino descent, Native American descent, and Asian descent. You have low and moderate income communities of white folks in this country. So we have to be very, very careful as we look at how wording is put into recommendations for public policy that's going to Capitol Hill, and what does that mean if once it's passed through Congress and when you start to peel away the layers to the onion. For the African American community, with 4 years of Barack Hussein Obama, who we elected the first African American president, it meant absolutely nothing when we began to look at the actual numbers put out by the Solar Foundation. Tax dollars to record the employment data as it relates to the solar industry. You will be able to find this information under our News and Events tab. If you click on our December link and you look at the National Association of Blacks in Solar Business Opportunity, you will see a link talking about the National Association of Blacks in Solar Green Economic Development Plan for Black America. I strongly recommend and suggest that you go there and you get that information. We've got about 8 more minutes left in our show today, ladies and gentlemen. As we said, we packed a lot of things in because we wanted to cover a lot of ground. But we wanted to make sure we could turn around and then sort of connect the dots as to what these things actually mean when we begin to talk to our community. In other words, make it plain. Now, there is supposed to be, through the Department, the Federal Regulatory Commission, that here in Washington, D.C., the creation of a Office of Public Participation. I'm going to reach out to see if I can get someone to come on from the Federal Regulatory Commission to talk about this new office that they're going to be creating. But this particular article is based around a workshop opportunity. And this article was basically put out by the Federal Regulatory Commission staff. It was published with Positive Change on February the 24th of 2021. The workshop will provide interested parties with the opportunities to provide input to the commission on the creation of an Office of Public Participation. The commission intends to establish, operate the Office of Public Participation to coordinate assistance to the public with respect to authorities exercised by the commission, increase assistance to those seeking to intervene in the commission's proceedings pursuant to Section 3319 of the Federal Power Act, U.S. 16 USC, which are basically the numbers of the case, the Congressional Directed Commission to provide the provided by June 25th, 2021, through the commission and the appropriations of both the House and Senate as it goes to Congress. Now, these things are important, ladies and gentlemen. As you know, I have beat the drum on this platform solely now and the future with its economic impact on Black America tirelessly to be able to get the funding to take this platform solely now in the future with its economic impact on Black America to the next level, which is to broadcast radio over the urban radio network. But we need at least a 120-minute section. That means we need 2 hours. That means we got to buy that time for 6 to a year. We want a year commitment where we can go ahead and pay WOL upfront for the time slot, and we'll be able to have the funds to cover the talent and production for a year. And I think, and I know, we can make a difference in how public policy is going to be pushed through the Biden administration as it affects the African American communities locally and nationally. But only with your help, ladies and gentlemen, can I get this done. And I know Lottie and Dottie and everybody is out here beating the drum with their own agendas, trying to say, look here, this subject matter is the most important thing that is coming down the path. But let me make it plain, ladies and gentlemen. If you cut off the power, there's no broadcast. If you cut off the heat, nobody's going to stay in the building. If you cut off the lights, nothing happens. You can't even get money out the ATM machines at your bank. So energy is something that we take for granted every day, but it doesn't take us for granted. We have made the 1% of the population who controls 98% of the wealth wealthier, because when you begin to look at the portfolios of the billionaire class in this country, they are well invested in the utility industry. This is why it's not that the coal and gas and oil industry are so-called pushing back against renewables, because they solar only has like a 3% market share. Wind, I think, maybe 10%. But that's out of 100%. Hydrogenetics is going to be a little higher because you got that's water. That's hydro. But in the master scheme of things, the large utility companies own it all themselves, ladies and gentlemen. So that is what this is all about. Now, as we close this show, we have been here for a solid hour bringing you news that we definitely hope that you can use here on Solar Now in the future with its economic impact on Black America. We are in a position to let people know that this show is brought to you by who every week? It's brought to you by the Positive Change Purchasing Cooperative. And you know the slogan for this show. If it's power in numbers, then the Positive Change Purchasing Cooperative captures that power for your financial benefit. The Positive Change Purchasing Cooperative LLC serves as an economic blueprint for solar, economic self-reliance for solar and renewable energy companies, both large and small, along with increasing market share for African-American-owned solar installation, design, and workforce development training companies to address the high effects of energy at our historically black colleges and universities, to utilize black-owned, black American-owned farms and HBCU campuses to develop capacity and initiatives for installation projects to bring down the under and underemployment among young black men and women locally and internationally, and to educate the black community locally and nationally about the economic impacts on climate change and the need for environmental education in the black community through Black Talks radio programs such as Solar Now and the Future with its economic impact on black America. Now, you know, ladies and gentlemen, we don't want you to meet us here. We want you to be this here each week. We are here on this platform. So until next week, we say go in peace as we close another edition of Solar Now and the Future with its economic impact. And before we close out, we want to thank all of you who tried to get in, who couldn't get in, or just chooses to listen.
Life is a song worth singing. Why don't you sing it? You hold the key in the palm of your hand. Use it. Don't blame your life on a master plan. Change it. Only you generate the power to decide what to do with your life. You're a fool if you think you're helpless. You control what you do with your life. Life is a song worth singing.